Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Today we're talking with Lisa Arkin, the director for Beyond Toxics. Welcome. Thank you for having me on the show, Roger. Can you tell me a little bit, Lisa, about how Beyond Toxics came about?
We were founded in about the year 2000 after a meeting of all the big environmental groups in Oregon, and they came together in a weekend retreat to talk about who was going to take on certain air pollution and water quality issues that had to do with polluting the environment. And each group realized that that wasn't really their bailiwick and who was working on pollution in the environment. And thus it was decided as a group to start something called Oregon Toxics Alliance, which then became Beyond Toxics. We actually do work on many different projects. Number one, we're an environmental justice nonprofit organization. And what does that mean, environmental justice? That means we're looking specifically at the intersection between environment and human health and the impacts of inequity in environmental pollution on certain communities. We mobilize through grassroots organizing methods. We mobilize those people who are most impacted to take action to create environmental health. So, for example, here in Astoria, what that would look like is talking to people, educating them, providing them with the data they need to take informed action. And in this case, we're talking about Oregon's poor history of forestry policy, especially where it comes to the use of herbicides, how herbicides impact communities like Astoria and the surrounding residential, urban, or rural areas, and how that impacts drinking water and our streams and rivers that serve our fisheries that employ so many people.
You mentioned inequity. Can you tell a little more about that? Are you suggesting that some people are more likely to be affected by toxic materials than others because they're more powerless, or what?
That's exactly it. When you have environmental health inequities, you have a situation where a community has less political clout. Perhaps they are less access to monetary resources. Maybe there are working class families that might even have parents working two jobs to keep the family going. They don't have time to attend those evening town hall meetings, and they certainly don't have time to drive down to our state capitol during a work day and rally or give testimony at a hearing. These are communities that, because they have less power in that way, are more likely to be targeted by industrial polluters. So inequity is both the placement of pollution and choosing spots where industries are less likely to encounter opposition, creating that false dichotomy of jobs versus the environment, and then also the body burden of multiple kinds of environmental toxics impacting those underserved communities. So causing more health impacts, thus creating more weakness in the infrastructure of the community.
Well, a good portion of the Oregon State Forest is actually here in Clatsop and Tillamook counties. Actually, the majority of the state forest is in these two areas. We don't have much in the way of national forest at all here. It's state forest and private forest lands. And you mentioned in your talk that the rules are sort of different on U.S. forest land.
So when we talk about the Oregon Forest Practice Laws, those are laws developed here in our state that apply to private industrial timber plantations and state forests. The federal government has its own set of laws, and, for example, in the federal government, the forests owned by the federal government, they don't allow massive clear-cutting. They've banned the use of helicopters to deliver poison from the sky, and they don't use chemicals to actually manage their forests in the way that is allowed in private industrial timber and state forests.
If a forest is clear-cut, does that ever happen without it being sprayed?
Right. It's a whole broken and very archaic system. A thing that Oregonians need to know is that Oregon has the weakest forest practices, the weakest laws, the weakest protections of any other state in the Pacific Northwest, and even states in the Southeast like Georgia. I'll give you a prime example because I know people in Astoria care a lot about water quality. In Oregon, there's no protection for a stream that isn't labeled a fish-bearing stream. Mm-hmm. And a fish-bearing stream has to be identified by various state agencies to be a habitat for fish. So you can clear cut right over those streams that aren't labeled for fish. You can apply pesticides right over those streams. And yet those are the same streams that serve as headwaters and tributaries to the rivers we're hoping to protect. It's senseless. And Oregon is the only state that does not protect tributaries and headwater streams. Every other state has a no-cut or a no-spray buffer to protect those streams. We are completely in the dark ages when it comes to protecting our water.
And as most of us know, water flows downhill, so whenever it's coming out of those streams that aren't supporting fish, it is flowing into other streams and actually eventually into the Columbia River and the estuary.
That's correct.
Well, take us through that a little bit, through what you discussed in your talk about what is actually going on in Oregon. You cited some awful things that happened near Gold Beach some years ago,
mm-hmm.
but the spraying of those kinds of chemicals is still going on. So what is the common practice now, and how do you deal with that?
Right. Well, let's try to imagine the scenario. So in Oregon, we allow clear-cutting. As you said, the laws actually sort of promote the use of clear-cutting over other types of ways of managing forests. So we clear-cut, and we clear-cut vast acreage, not 10 acres here or 50 acres there, but 80, 100, 140 acres and more get clear-cut. So you have a situation of steep slopes, denuded of trees. The soils are not stable. Then they bring in, after the clear cutting, which requires the use of very heavy equipment, it's all automated. That equipment is compacting the soils and damaging feeder creeks and things like that as they build these roads and they go right over streams and things like that. They're also, I have to say, this is something not many people think about. In order to get that heavy equipment in there, in order to load the logs on trucks and drive those trucks out, in order to bring in the fuel trucks and the herbicide trucks, they have to build a lot of roads. And they have to haul in a lot of gravel to put on those roads. When I think of the resources and the use of fossil fuels and the exhaust and everything that goes into just getting the site ready, mm-hmm. it's pretty mind-boggling. But here you have it. So they've built the road, they've hauled in all this gravel, and this is happening all over the state, so you have to think big. Then they take those trees out, and they're left with this denuded land. The first rain on the land will pull those soils that are no longer stable down into the streams, mm-hmm. which then creates sedimentation. So now you have dirty streams, and those streams are not fit for drinking water. They're not fit for salmon and other fish species because they can't smell and they can't see and they can't find their mates and they can't lay their eggs. But then anything that's left on the site is pushed together into these giant slash piles. So now you have more compacting of soil and more scraping of soils. And then those are set on fire. So you're creating a lot of CO2, mm-hmm. Carbon dioxide that you're emitting into the air, and you're creating vast air pollution problems for nearby communities. Then they drive these big trucks full of vats of chemicals back up into these areas where they've clear cut, load those chemicals into the tanks of helicopters, and use helicopters to spray without regard to what's below, a blanket of chemicals across the landscape. These chemicals don't necessarily stay where they're sprayed. They drift at the time of spray on wind currents, and because you have the rotating blades of the helicopter moving those chemicals through the air, and then they're taken back up as the land heats up and cools down each day as volatilizing vapors that then move through our communities as fog or rain or mist. And that happens on a repeating cycle of every 25 to 30 years. That's how I would paint the picture.
Right. And what you're suggesting is that the concept that you can spray and be very precise and spray it in a given spot and it's all going to stay in that spot doesn't really hold true.
It's a fallacy to think that spray of herbicide somehow hits a target and stays there and doesn't move anywhere. I often am asked, why do they spray? So let's address that for a second, because many listeners might be saying, well, that whole scenario makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Why are they using harsh chemicals out in the forest? The way our forest practice laws work, it encourages timber plantations. So we shouldn't even be using the word forest. These are not forests. They are monocrop plantations of Douglas fir trees. They're planted on 8 to 10 foot centers, rows and rows for miles and miles of genetically enhanced species of tree. In order to get that fast growth that they're looking for so they can have faster and faster grow and cut rotations, grow and cut, grow and cut, they have to spray herbicides to kill anything that might compete with that cash crop, the Douglas fir. They want to kill oak trees. They want to kill madrone, alder, maple, cascara. They want to kill salmonberry and the other kinds of native plant types in Oregon that usually serve as home to birds and deer and elk and provide food for so many species of wildlife. All of that has to go away so that the tree has no competition, because the soils, as I mentioned before, have been compacted and stripped of their nutrients.
You mentioned beaver as well.
Right. The practice in Oregon is to drop pellets of rodenticides from aircraft across, again, vast acreages of land to kill mountain beaver. They drop something that usually is an anticoagulant. Mm-hmm. That means the...
Like rat poison.
Yeah. So mountain beaver are a native species in Oregon. They're a very important part of the whole ecosystem. And sure, mountain beaver, they're not the kind of beaver that build a dam and a stream. They're the kind that live on the land. And it's true, one of their food sources are... they like to gnaw on the bark of little trees. But these pellets are distributed across the landscape. We don't know what kind of other animals might be eating them, but we do know that when birds of prey, like a hawk, pick up an animal that's ingested an anticoagulant, that animal can also spread the poison to the predatory bird and then result in the death of animals up the food chain.
What about, this is a silly question, but we're talking about spraying herbicides. What's wrong with that? Aren't they just dangerous to herbs?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we learned in Vietnam when Agent Orange, an herbicide, right, was sprayed throughout the landscape there, that it's indeed quite dangerous to humans. The reason for that is herbicides work on growth hormone. Plants have growth hormones. Humans have growth hormones. We share a lot of the same basic chemical processes in our body. So 2,4-D, which, by the way, was half of what Agent Orange was in Vietnam. So if someone out there is thinking, Agent Orange, that was banned years ago, Well, the particular Agent Orange might have been banned, but the things that went in to make Agent Orange have not been banned and are still used heavily.
2,4-D is very widely used, isn't it? One of the most widely used?
It's one of the, I think, the second most frequently used herbicide in Oregon's forests, I should say, Oregon's timber plantations today. So, yes, it's a suspected carcinogen, and it's a known hormone disruptor. The way it works on a plant is if you spray 2,4-D on a plant in the spring when it's growing, it actually causes a proliferation of growth, too fast a growth, and the cells basically burst. It's very much like cancer. Too many cells that take over other cells and sort of invade the living system. So 2,4-D works in plants like cancer works in humans. And we, again, we share the same chemical processes with plants. There is an abundance of scientific research showing that 2,4-D in humans is extremely damaging.
We have a conflict in this area between two historic industries, the timber industry on the one hand and the fishery industry on the other hand. And a while back, I attended a presentation by some of the fishing folks, and they were talking about their findings, and this actually took place on a stream in the Clatsop State Forest, where they were looking at survival rates of salmon. And the survival rate between the salmon fry and the smolt, which then go down the river to become salmon, was extremely low. It was in the neighborhood of maybe 1 or 2% of the fry actually survived to become smolt. And they were citing two things, and one of the two things was water temperature, and the other was the herbicides. And the temperature, obviously, would be affected also by clear cuts, would it not?
It most certainly is, and even the Board of Forestry, a board that tends to want to perpetuate the old-fashioned, outdated forest practices law, acknowledges that stream temperature is a problem because of clear cutting. You're denuding the landscape of any trees which provide shade for feeder streams and creeks and then larger streams. That water heats up and it travels downstream to as warm water and heats up our larger rivers. So water temperature is completely connected to and a result of clear cutting. So the Department of Forestry manages forest operations, clear cutting, road building, spraying of herbicide. And someone who's going to spray an herbicide does have to report that to the Department of Forestry. And those notifications, they're called, are filed. But they don't provide a lot of information. So let's just unpack that for a moment. A notification informs the Board of Forestry that an aerial herbicide application, for example, will take place. They can list 18 to 20 chemicals. They don't actually have to say which chemicals they're planning to use. And we should talk in a moment about chemical mixtures, but they can list large, long lists of chemicals so that no one really knows what's going to be used out in the environment. They can give a 12-month window of when they plan to spray. So you have no idea when a spray is actually going to occur. Here's a great example of that. There was recently here in Tillamook County an aerial herbicide spray by Weyerhaeuser that occurred very near Oswald State Park and Short Sands Beach. Not even the state park manager knew that a spray was going to occur. And people were coming to use that park for recreation, to take their children, to take their dogs, to take their visiting relatives, to play on the beach. And no one knew that the aerial herbicide spray was occurring. People did smell it, but how are they to know in advance? That is unconscionable. It's like caveman practices. We should at least be able to alert people so they can make the choice, if they wish, to avoid the potential of exposure. So back to these notifications. They don't provide very helpful information, and the greater Oregon public has demanded what we call timely notification. At least 3 to 5 days notice and then an update. It would be very easy to provide. It's the only sane and humane thing to do. And yet our Board of Forestry and Department of Foresters and timber companies are doing everything they can to prevent that from happening. Very low percentage of herbicide applications are monitored by our state agency due to lack of information, lack of timely information, and probably lack of enough staff to monitor them all. I mean, they're going on all over our state during every spring and every fall. I've heard from many Oregonians, even those that are second and third generation descendants of loggers' families, that they knew about the logging, but they didn't know about herbicides.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the folks down in Curry County who were injured were either loggers themselves or children of loggers, logging families, and they said, we had no idea about the use of herbicides. I think that the practice has been ramping up in Oregon because our laws are so weak. So one thing that the listeners need to know is that it's not just one chemical in that tank. It's not just 2,4-D as if
right.
That somehow would be okay. It's not okay. It's a tank mix of 3 to 4 active ingredients plus these things called adjuvants, which are used to enhance the toxic properties. So we have actual spray records that show that typical, it's 2,4-D mixed with atrazine, a very powerful endocrine disruptor, mixed with hexazinone, and a relative of 2,4-D. Maybe glyphosate's thrown in there too, and now a known carcinogen or probable
carcinogen.
Which is
banned in a lot of places in Europe now.
So is atrazine, and so is 2,4-D.
Yeah.
They put it all into one tank. They throw in crop oil to disperse it in the environment and make sure it sticks to everything. They put in a couple of adjuvants that, you know, make sure it's penetrating the leaf surface. And then they spray it from the sky,
yeah.
A completely uncontrolled way to distribute a poison in the environment. They also, they meaning the private timber corporations, are spraying often twice a year. They spray their heaviest mix in the springtime to kill anything that might be emerging in the spring. Remember we talked about salmonberry or alder trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then they spray again in the fall to kind of put the last slash, you know, the last clubbing down for anything
right.
that might want to grow. And then they do this for 3, 4, 5 years in a row. So we've tracked this and we've found that, let's say, over a 6-year period, they might have sprayed 5 out of 6 years. And of the seasons, they might have sprayed a majority of the seasons in the spring and the fall, these tank mixtures. When you think about this going on all over Oregon, so much of our land in Western Oregon is private timber plantations that provide the sources of our drinking water and our the water salmon need to survive. If it's going on year after year, season after season, tank load after tank load, with no respect for environmental integrity, this is a major problem that our state has to solve. Oregon has the most complaints from regular rural residents about exposure, sickness, death of pets, harm to farm animals, death of sheep, death of goats from spray. And our legislators not doing much about it, and our state agencies are not doing much about it.
Well, is there a better way?
There is a better way. We have a number of smaller timber, private timber interests that are making sure their logs are certified FSC, which is a sustainability certification. And with that certification, there's a lot of restrictions about clear cutting and the use of chemicals. There's a lot in there about fair wages for workers. And they're making sure that they are providing for a biologically diverse forest. Now I am using the word forest and not the word plantation, because they're encouraging the growth of marketable trees such as oak and alder, because those are beautiful woods. I mean, everyone mm-hmm. loves oak furniture or oak floors. And in fact, Zena Forest in Yamhill County, Hyla Woods in Washington County, and Shady Creek in Lane County all are providing beautiful timber from diverse, ecologically diverse forest lands where they're protecting all streams, not using any herbicides, marketing both Douglas fir plus maple and oak and alder, and doing rotations that are very sensitive to maintaining the integrity of the environment. People, when you go, when any of us need lumber for whatever purpose, to build a porch or to remodel, think about those businesses and look to contact them for your wood needs. They need a little extra notice because they do cut sometimes to order, but then you'll be promoting an Oregon brand grown right here in Oregon and harvested and marketed with the kind of values we desire and respect in Oregon, which is environmental integrity, sustainability, fair wages, and protection of our natural resources like rivers. I encourage everyone there to check our website at beyondtoxics.org. We have some great videos up there. We just produced a new one called Timbers Cover Up. You can Google it on YouTube, Timbers Cover Up. It's only 4 minutes, but it explains the problem with the Oregon way of doing things in industrial forests. We need to demand change. Each and every person who cares about the quality of their drinking water, about the viability of our salmon fishing industry, about the quality of our air, and about the role of forests during climate change, should write a letter to their legislature, should write a letter to the editor, should make a few phone calls, and show up when we have a rally day at the state capitol, when we're going to be there demanding sensible, modernized updates to the Forest Practices Act so that we're not harming Oregonians just to ship some sawed-off logs over to China and Japan to be made into pellets.
Well, let's talk about that website address again, because there's an awful lot of information on your site that people can go and find to kind of follow up on our discussion today.
BeyondToxics.org, that's all one word. And we have a kind of a sister website, too, which has just a focus on forestry, and that's called Oregon Forest Voices, all one word, OregonForestVoices.org. And on that site, we have that video, Timbers Cover Up, but we also have the stories from people around the state of what's happened to them because of rapacious logging and the lack of values in our industrial timber corporate community about the health of our communities and the viability of our waterways and our air. And this is not anti-timber. Never have we been anti-timber. We're there to promote updated, sane, protective Oregon laws that protect not only forest health, but the health of communities and the communities that need to make a living from our natural resources.
Thank you. Lisa Arkin from Beyond Toxics.
Thanks so much, Roger.
And you've been listening to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rucka. Thanks for being with us.